Interlude, Dead. I bought her a ring because I was desperate that she would leave me. I didn't want to be this injured and alone during COVID. I was high on 1,800 milligrams of hydrocodone when I asked her to marry me. I had even asked for her family's blessing. Then I'd proposed, high as a kite, and on one knee, and she knew it too, and said yes. I was in Switzerland at the time, at yet another rehab. This one was at a villa on Lake Geneva with its own butler and chef, the kind of luxurious place where you were guaranteed to not meet anybody else, thereby pretty much defeating the purpose of every rehab I had ever heard of. But what it lacked in fellow sufferers, it made up for in easy availability of drugs, which again, unfortunately, did not differentiate it from other high-priced rehabs. I could make millions if I sued these places, but it would divert more attention to the situation, which I didn't want to do. I did my usual trick, complaining about intense stomach pain when in fact I was okay. It still felt like I was constantly doing a sit-up, so it was very uncomfortable, but it wasn't pain. So they'd given me hydrocodone, as much as I could actually feel, which turned out to be 1,800 milligrams a day. To put that in perspective, if you broke your thumb and had a kind doctor, he or she would probably prescribe you 5.5 milligram pills. Not enough to put a dent in this guy. I was also doing ketamine infusions every day. Ketamine was a very popular street drug in the 80s. There is a synthetic form of it now, and it's used for two reasons: to ease pain and help with depression. Has my name written all over it. They might as well have called it Maddie. Ketamine felt like a giant exhale. They'd bring me into a room, sit me down, put headphones on me so I could listen to music, blindfold me, and put an IV in. That was the hard part. I'm always a little dehydrated because I don't drink enough water. Big surprise. So finding a vein was no fun. I was like a fucking pincushion by the end of it. Into the IV went a smidge of Ativan, which I could actually feel, and then I was on a ketamine drip for an hour. As I lay there in the pitch dark listening to Bon Iver, I would disassociate, see things. I'd been in therapy for so long that I wasn't even freaked out by this. Oh, there's a horse over there? Fine, might as well be. As the music played and the K ran through me, it all became about the ego and the death of the ego, and I often thought I was dying during that hour. Oh, I thought, this is what happens when you die. Yet I would continually sign up for this shit because it was something different, and anything different is good, which just so happens to be one of the last lines of Groundhog Day. Taking K is like being hit in the head with a giant happy shovel, but the hangover was rough and outweighed the shovel. Ketamine was not for me. Back in my room, the butler had laid out more clothes I wouldn't change into, the chef had prepared yet another healthy meal I wouldn't touch, and I went back to looking at Lake Geneva a lot, completely fucking high. But not the good kind of high, a loopy, drunk feeling that I did not enjoy. I was also now, somehow, engaged. At some point, the rehab geniuses decided that to help my stomach pain, they'd put some kind of weird medical device in my back, but they'd need to do a surgery to insert it. So I stayed up all night taking 1,800 milligrams of hydrocodone for the next day's surgery. In the operating room, they gave me propofol, you know, the drug that killed Michael Jackson. I learned then and there that Michael Jackson didn't want to be high. He wanted to be out. Zero consciousness. And yet another masterful talent taken from us by this terrible disease. I was given the shot at 11 a.m. I woke up 11 hours later in a different hospital. Apparently, the propofol had stopped my heart for 5 minutes. It wasn't a heart attack, I didn't flatline, but nothing had been beating. If I may be so bold, please pause your listening of this audiobook for 5 minutes. Look at your phone, starting now. That's a fucking long time, right? I was told that some beefy Swiss guy really didn't want the guy from Friends dying on his table and did CPR on me for the full 5 minutes, beating and pounding my chest. If I hadn't been on Friends, would he have stopped at 3 minutes? Did Friends save my life again? He may have saved my life, but he also broke 8 of my ribs. As I lay there in agony the following day, the head doctor waltzed in, all full of himself, and said, "You will get no ketamine here, and if you need to go to a rehab, there is one we can send you to." "I'm already in fucking rehab," I screamed, and in a rare show of physical anger, I knocked over the table next to me, which was covered in medical supplies. This scared the doctor, and he promptly left the room. I apologized for the mess I had made and got the hell out of there. The rehab I was speaking of had already done a rapid detox, but they put me under for the wrong 2 days. The first two. It should have been days 3 and 4. By the time I came around, the detox fully hit, and I'd gone from 1,800 milligrams to bupkis. Not much a butler and a chef can do about that. Those 8 broken ribs were, by the way, much the same injury that the New Orleans Saints quarterback Drew Brees suffered in a game in November 2021 against the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Brees would break 3 more the following week and puncture his lung just to be better than me. But then he missed 4 games, so I'd argue we're at least even, which makes me feel tough. Right in the middle of all this madness, but prior to the rib thing, I took a meeting with Adam McKay about a movie called Don't Look Up. There was no Chandler that day. I wasn't on. I couldn't get it up for that. We just talked for a while, and as I walked out, I said very calmly, "Well, I'd love to help you in any way I can with this thing." Adam said, "I think you just did." I got the call the following day that he was hiring me. This would be the biggest movie I'd gotten yet. It promised to be a little calm within the storm. I was to play a Republican journalist and was supposed to have 3 scenes with Meryl Streep. Yes, that's right. I got to do a group scene with Jonah Hill, among others, in Boston where the movie was filmed. I was on 1,800 milligrams of hydrocodone then, too, but nobody noticed. But with the broken ribs, there was no way I could continue. So I never got to do my scenes with Meryl. It was heartbreaking, but I was in too much pain. God knows how Breeds continued to throw a football, but you don't get to do a scene with Meryl Streep with broken ribs, and I couldn't smile without it hurting like fuck. Being in Don't Look Up didn't work out because my life was on fire, but I learned an important lesson. I was hireable in something big without putting on a show. In that meeting, Adam and I had just been 2 men talking. I will treasure that moment, that day, that man. What a good guy, and I sincerely hope our paths cross again. I'll be sure to check it's actually him next time. When it came time to leave Switzerland, I was still on 1,800 milligrams of oxy every single fucking day. I was told that once back in Los Angeles, I'd still be able to get that much, and I needed it. Just to stay on level. As ever, this was not getting me high. This was purely maintenance, so I didn't go through agonies. I flew back on a private jet. There was no way I could fly commercial, given that everyone in the world recognized my damn face, and it cost me a cool $175,000 to do so. Back in L.A., I went to see my doctor. "I need 1,800 milligrams a day," I said. "No point beating around the bush." "Oh, no," she said. "We're not giving you that at all. Cancer patients only get 100 milligrams. This only upped my gratitude that I didn't have cancer. "But the doctor in Switzerland told me that's what I'd be on when I got home." "Oh, they'll consult," she said, "but I'm in charge now. Here's 30 milligrams. This would not do. I would get incredibly sick. There was only one thing left to do for it. That very same night, I booked another $175,000 private jet and flew right back to Switzerland. I need you to combine my morning and evening dose. Ich verche kein Englisch, the Swiss nurse said. This was going to be a problem. My pressing need to change the rules versus her lack of English. This was all done in some weird German-English game of charades. I don't need a pill at 6 o'clock in the morning. I need it when it's scary, at night. I can't find the center of the fear. It's general. Also, I can't sleep, so there's a negotiation every single night with myself. My mind races. The ideas come so fast. I get auditory hallucinations, too. I hear voices and conversations, and sometimes I even talk back. Sometimes, too, I'll think that somebody wants to hand me something, and I put my hand out to get that nothing from no one. Sober or not, this troubled me a bit. On top of everything else, I'm crazy? It's not schizophrenia, just a damn load of voices. The voices, I'm told, do not make me a crazy person. They're called auditory hallucinations, and they happen to people all the time. There is no cure for the voices. Of course there isn't. Actually, I can think of a cure. It's called being somebody else. Either way, I needed those pills as one shot at night without saving any for the morning. Morning, evening, together, I said, miming 8 pills in my hand, not one. Nie kein Atnug, she said. Tomorrow morning, no pill, now instead, I said extremely slowly. Ich habe kein Agnung, was sehr brakun. You and everybody else, no one knows what I need. Back in L.A. one more time, trying to sober up, I think, wait. How did I get engaged? There are dogs living in my house. How did this happen? I asked her parents, begged for her hand while high, and put up with the dogs. That's how scared I was of being abandoned. Chapter 4. Like I've Been There Before. It was so special it felt like we'd all been together in a previous life or something. Or in a future life, but certainly this one. This was a real day, but a day that dreams were made of. For the longest time, I didn't really want to talk too much about friends. Partly that was because I'd done plenty of other stuff too, but all anybody ever wanted to talk about was Chandler. It's like James Taylor talking about Fire and Rain, a gruesome little tale if you've ever heard what that's about. It's like a band who've written a brilliant new album, but all anyone wants to hear when they play live is the hits. I always admired Kurt Cobain's refusal to play Smells Like Teen Spirit, or Led Zeppelin's refusal to play Stairway to Heaven. The New York Times once said, "Friends sticks to Perry like a sweaty shirt." They weren't right about that. In fact, it's just fucking cruel. But they weren't the only ones to think it. I was so good at something, yet I was being penalized for it. I left my blood, sweat, and tears on stage every Friday night. We all did. And that should be a good thing, not something that says we can only excel at that. I'm not complaining. If you're going to be typecast, that's the way to do it. But in recent years, I've come to understand just what friends means to people. And we knew from the very start that it was something very, very special. I was the last actor to be cast in the entire pilot season of 1994. In fact, I got the gig on the actual final day of pilot season. With LAX 2194 thankfully in the rearview mirror, I was free to be Chandler Bing. The following Monday after the Friday I was hired was day one of my new life. This was big. And I guess we all felt that way, because we all showed up dead on time. Well, Matt LeBlanc was first every single day, Aniston last every single day. The cars got nicer, but the order stayed the same. We sat around the table and all met each other for the first time. That is, except for me and Jennifer Aniston. Jennifer and I had met through mutual acquaintances about 3 years earlier. I was immediately taken by her. How could I not be? And I liked her, and I got the sense that she was intrigued too. Maybe it was going to be something. Back then, I got two jobs in one day. One was Haywire, an America's Funniest Home Video type show, and the other was a sitcom. So I called Jennifer and I said, "You're the first person I wanted to tell this to." Bad idea. I could feel ice forming through the phone. Looking back, it was clear that this made her think that I liked her too much, or in the wrong kind of way. And I only compounded the error by then asking her out. She declined, which made it very difficult to actually go out with her, but said that she'd love to be friends with me. And I compounded the compound by blurting, "We can't be friends." Now, a few years later, ironically, we were friends. Fortunately, even though I was still attracted to her, I thought she was so great. That first day, we were able to sail right past that past and focus on the fact that we had both gotten the best jobs Hollywood had to offer. Everyone else was brand new to me. Courtney Cox was wearing a yellow dress and was cripplingly beautiful. I had heard about Lisa Kudrow from a mutual friend, and she was just as gorgeous and hilarious and incredibly smart as my friend had said. Matty LeBlanc was nice and a cool customer, and David Schwimmer had had his hair cut really short. He had been playing Pontius Pilate for his theater troupe in Chicago, over his hangdog face, and was incredibly funny right away, warm and smart and creative. After me, he was the guy who pitched the most jokes. I probably pitched 10 jokes a day, and two of them got in. They weren't just jokes for me. I'd pitch jokes for everybody. I'd go up to Lisa and say, "You know, it might be funny if you tried to say this," and she'd try it. The director, Jimmy Burrows, was the best in the business, too. He directed both Taxi and Cheers. He knew instinctually that job one was for us to get to know each other and generate chemistry. Immediately, there was electricity in the air. I'd always wanted to be the only funny one. But now, at the ripe old age of 24, I quickly realized that it's better if everyone is funny. I could already tell this was going to be big. I knew it from the start, but didn't say anything out loud. Partly that was because it isn't unheard of for an actor to fuck up a table read so badly that they were politely asked to leave before a minute of shooting took place. But that would be tomorrow. For now, Jimmy took the six of us to Monica's apartment set and told us just to talk to each other. And so we did. We talked and joked about romance, our careers, our loves, our losses, and the bond that Jimmy knew would be critical had begun. The six of us ate lunch together outside on a beautiful spring day. As we ate, Courtney, the only established name of the group back then, said, "There are no stars here. This is an ensemble show. We're all supposed to be friends." Given her status, she'd been on Family Ties and in Ace Ventura and a guest spot on Seinfeld and had danced with Bruce Springsteen in the video for Dancing in the Dark. She could have been everything and everybody. She could easily have said, "I'm the star." Hell, she could have had her lunch somewhere else. And we would have to be fine with it. Instead, she simply said, "Let's really work and get to know each other." She said it's what she noticed about how it worked on Seinfeld, and she wanted it to be true about Friends, too. So, we did what she suggested. From that first morning, we were inseparable. We ate every meal together, played poker. At the start, I was a full-on joke man, cracking gags like a comedy machine whenever I could, probably to the annoyance of everyone, trying to get everybody to like me because of how funny I was. Because why else would anybody like me? It would take 15 years for me to learn that I didn't need to be a joke machine. That first afternoon, we were assigned dressing rooms, which eventually didn't matter because we were never in them. We were always together. As we walked to our cars and said goodbye that first evening, I remember thinking, "I'm happy." This was not an emotion I was altogether used to. That night, I called my friends, except for Craig Bierko, given what had happened, and told them what a wonderful day I'd had. I then spent yet another night at college, the Formosa, as was my custom. I remember saying that night that I was on a show that was so good it was better than anything I could have dreamed of writing myself. My friends were all so happy for me. But even then, I could sense a shift. Maybe I was growing out of this Formosa thing. I had a life-changing job that I had to, hell, I desperately wanted to report to in the morning. So I drank far less than usual. My apartment even had a life cycle in the back, and I used it every day, dropping about 10 pounds of baby alcohol fat between the pilot and the first episode. That night, I went to bed thinking, I can't wait to go back there tomorrow. Next morning, as I drove from Sunset and Doheny over the Cahuenga Pass to the Warner Brothers lot in Burbank, I realized that I was leaning towards the windshield as I drove. I wanted to be there. That would be true for the next decade. Day two was big. We reported to a new building, Building 40, for our first table read. I was nervous and excited, and yet confident too. I was always good at table reads, but there was still the looming thought that anyone could be fired and replaced. Lisa Kudrow, for example, had originally been cast as Roz on Frasier, but had been fired during the rehearsal process by none other than Friends director Jimmy Burrows. If jokes didn't land or something was off, well, anybody could be replaced before they'd even properly found their way to their dressing room. But I knew Chandler. I could shake hands with Chandler. I was him. And I looked a lot like him, too. That day, the room was packed. In fact, it was standing room only. There were writers, executives, network people. There must have been 100 people in the room. But I was a song and dance man, and this is where I excelled. We got reacquainted with Marta Kaufman, David Crane, and Kevin Bright, the people behind the show who had hired us. And almost instantly, we all felt they were our parental figures. Before the table read began, we all went around the room introducing ourselves and saying what we did for the show. Then it was time to read. How would it go? Would the chemistry we'd only just started to create show up? Or were we just six young hopefuls making believe that this would be our big break? We needn't have worried. We were ready. The universe was ready. We were pros. The lines flew out of our mouths. No one made a mistake. All the jokes landed. We finished to thunderous applause. Everyone could smell money. The cast could smell fame. After the read, the six of us piled into a van and were brought to the actual set at stage 24 to begin rehearsing. But it was the run-through at the end of the day that sealed the deal. The jokes, the chemistry, the script, the direction, everything was magical. All the elements seemed to meld into one hilarious, cogent, powerful whole. And we all knew it. This show was going to work, and it was going to change everyone's lives forever. I swear there was a popping sound. If you listened really closely, you could hear it. It was the sound of people's dreams coming true. It was everything I thought I wanted. I was going to fill all the holes with friends like us. Fuck Charlie Sheen. I was going to be so famous that all the pain I carried with me would melt like frost in the sunlight. And any new threats would bounce off me as though this was a force field I could cloak myself in. There is an unwritten law in show business that to be funny, you had to either look funny or be older. But here we were, six attractive people, all in their 20s, all knocking every joke out of the park. That evening, I drove home on a cloud. There was no traffic. All the lights were green. A trip that should have taken a half an hour took 15 minutes. The attention that I always felt had eluded me was about to fill every corner of my life, like a room illuminated by a flash of lightning. People were going to like me now. I was going to be enough. I mattered. I wasn't too needy. I was a star. Nothing was going to stop us now. No one walking into a ballroom would have to turn around and notice me. All eyes would be on me now, not the pretty woman walking 3 feet in front of me. We rehearsed the rest of the week, and it was then that we began to notice something else. I've been an actor since 1985, and that has never happened before or since, and it was beautiful. The bosses were not in the least tyrannical. In fact, it was a truly creative atmosphere. We could pitch jokes, and the best joke won, no matter where it came from. The craft service lady said something funny, put it in. It didn't matter. So not only was I there as an actor, but my creative juices were flowing too. The creators took each of us out for lunch to get to know us, so they could incorporate some aspects of our real personalities into the show. At my lunch, I said two things. One, that even though I consider myself not unattractive, I had terrible luck with women, and that my relationships tended towards the disastrous. And two, that I was not comfortable in any silence at all. I have to break any such moment with a joke. And this became a built-in excuse for Chandler Bing to be funny, perfect for a sitcom. And Chandler wasn't much good with women either, as he shouts at Janice as she leaves his apartment, "I've scared you. I've said too much. I'm awkward and hopeless and desperate for love." But think of a better character for a sitcom. Someone who is uncomfortable in silence and has to break the silence with a joke. This was all too true, both for Chandler and for me. Fairly early in the making of Friends, I realized that I was still crushing badly on Jennifer Aniston. Our hellos and goodbyes became awkward, and then I'd ask myself, how long can I look at her? Is 3 seconds too long? But that shadow disappeared in the hot glow of the show. That and her deafening lack of interest. On tape nights, nobody made a mistake. We might have run scenes over if a joke didn't land. All the writers would huddle together and rewrite, but mistakes just never happened. So many shows have blooper reels, but there are only a few for Friends. From the pilot on, in fact, that pilot was error-free. We were the New York Yankees, slick, professional, top of our game from the very start. We were ready. And I was talking in a way that no one had talked in sitcoms before, hitting odd emphases, picking a word in a sentence you might not imagine was the beat, utilizing the Murray Perry cadence. I didn't know it yet, but my way of speaking would filter into the culture across the next few decades. For now, though, I was just trying to find interesting ways into lines that were already funny, but that I thought I could truly make dance. Marta Kaufman was later to say that writers would underline the word not usually emphasized in a sentence just to see what I would do with it. Even when there were issues with the characters, we were able to work them out to the point where the solutions created their own iconic moments. When I first read the script, I knew it was different because it was so character-driven and smart. But early on, Matt LeBlanc was concerned that because he was this kind of cool, macho ladies' man in the script, Rachel, Monica, and Phoebe wouldn't be friends with him, wouldn't like him that much. And that made his character less believable. It didn't help that Matt was very good-looking. He had leading man looks, even to the point where I was a little jealous of that when I first saw him. But he was so nice and funny that any jealousy I had disappeared. But still, he hadn't been able to find the right way into his character. He was the one character in the show that had not been properly defined. He was described as a cool Pacino type, out-of-work actor, so that's how he played it. But it still wasn't working. At one point during a wardrobe session, he put on brown leather pants, which were thankfully nixed by everyone, especially Marta, who was in charge. Then came the moment early in the run where he has an exchange with Courtney about a woman he's been seeing and how the sex wasn't working out. Courtney asks him if he thought of being there for the girl, and Joey just simply didn't understand that concept. That was the moment he turned from being a ladies' man to a lovable, useless, dumb puppy. He underlined this by doing a running joke of things being repeated to him and him not following them. He had found his position in the show, which was basically as a big dumb brother to Rachel, Monica, and Phoebe. Everyone was in place. Occasionally, Matt would come into my dressing room, mostly during season one, and ask me how to say his lines. And I would tell him, and he would go downstairs and he would nail it. But he gets most improved player because by season 10, I was going into his room and asking him how he would say certain of my lines. This was all to come. For now, we were filming shows ahead of our fall 1994 air date. And as yet, no one knew who we were. With the shows in the can, all that was left to find out was our time slot. NBC knew they had something special, so they put us right between Mad About You and Seinfeld. It was the perfect spot. Plum. This was before streaming, so your time slot was crucial. It was still the days of appointment TV, when folks would run home to catch the 8 p.m. show or the 9 p.m. show, and people organized their lives around their shows, not the other way around. So 8:30 on a Thursday between two huge shows was a massive deal. We flew to New York on the Warner Brothers jet for the upfronts. The upfronts are when a show is presented to the affiliates. It was on this trip that they told us the name of the show was now Friends. When they renamed it, I thought it was a horrible idea. I never said I was a smart person. And Friends was a smash with the affiliates, too. Everything was lining up. In New York, we were celebrating, getting drunk, partying, then on to Chicago for more upfronts, more partying. Then we had to wait a summer before the show first aired. I filled that summer with three notable things: gambling in Vegas at the behest of Jimmy Burrows, a trip to Mexico on my own, and a makeout session in a closet with Gwyneth Paltrow. I was back in Williamstown, Massachusetts, when I met Gwyneth. She was doing a play there, and I was visiting my grandfather. At some big party, we slipped off into a broom cupboard and made out. We were both still unknown enough that it didn't make it into the tabloids, but with that in mind, it felt to Jimmy Burrows to give me a reality check. After the upfronts, it was clear the show was going to be a hit. So Jimmy flew us all to Vegas on the jet. We watched the pilot of Friends on the way, and once we arrived, he gave us $100 and told us to go gamble it and have fun, because once the show aired in the fall, we'd never be able to do it again. "Your lives are going to utterly change," Jimmy said. "So do some things in public now, because once you're as famous as you're about to be, you'll never be able to do them again." And that's what we did. We six new friends got drunk and gambled and wandered through the casinos, just six strangers on a weekend trip, unknown to anyone, no one asking for our autographs or photos, none of us being chased by paparazzi, a million miles from what was coming, which was every single moment of our lives being documented in public for all to see forever. I still wanted fame, but I already could taste a wild and weird flavor in the air. Would fame, that elusive lover, really fill all the holes I carried around with me? What would it be like to not be able to put 20 on black in some harsh-lit casino, a vodka tonic in my hand without someone shouting, "Matthew Perry just put 20 on black. Everyone, come and see." This was the last summer of my life when I could make out at a party with a beautiful young woman called Gwyneth, and no one save Gwyneth and I cared. Would the payoff be worth it? Would giving up a normal life be worth the price paid of people digging through my trash, clicking pictures through telephoto lenses of me at my worst or best or everything in between? Would I ever again be able to anonymously replicate my 21st birthday, when at the Sofitel across from the Beverly Center, I'd drunk 7 7-and-7s, poured a bottle of wine into a huge brandy snifter, you know, the one they put on pianos for tips, ordered a cab, got into the back of the cab with the snifter, still sipping the wine, tried to give directions to my home when I could only pronounce the letter L. Only for the guy up front to yell, "What the fuck are you doing?" Because he wasn't a cab driver. I had just gotten into the back of somebody's car. Most important, would these holes get filled? Would I want to trade places with David Pressman or Craig Bierko, or they with me? What would I tell them down the line when my name became a shorthand for stand-up comedians and late-night hosts, a shorthand that meant addict? What would I tell them when complete strangers hated me, loved me, and everything in between? What would I tell them? And what would I tell God when he reminded me of my prayer, the one I'd whispered 3 weeks before I got friends? "God, you can do whatever you want with me. Just please make me famous." He was about to keep one half of the bargain, but this also meant he could do whatever he wanted with me as the other half. I was completely at the mercy of God, who was sometimes merciful and sometimes thought it was perfectly fine to put his own son on a fucking cross. Which way would he choose for me? Which one would St. Peter pick? The gold, the red, or the blue? I guess I was about to find out. With Jimmy Burrow's words about impending fame still ringing in my ears, I figured I should take one last trip as an anonymous person. Late in the summer of 1994, I flew alone to Mexico. I'd recently broken up with my girlfriend Gabby and decided to go on a booze cruise solo. In Cabo, I wandered about, getting drunk and calling girls in L.A. from my room. Then, each night on the cruise, I'd head to some kind of weird party where everybody was all nervous until they brought out a jug of booze. Then, it was on. I was lonely. I didn't get laid. It was hot in Cabo, but cold inside me. I could feel God watching me, waiting. The most unnerving part was, I knew God was omniscient, which meant he knew already what he had in store for me. Friends premiered on Thursday, September 22, 1994. It initially hit number 17 in the rankings, which was really good for a brand new show. The reviews were mostly stellar, too. Friends promises to be offbeat and seductive. The cast is appealing, the dialogue is pitch-perfect, 1994. Friends comes as close as a new series can get to having everything. The New York Times. Friends has so many good moves that there's really nothing to dislike. It's all so light and frothy that after each episode, you may be hard-pressed to recall precisely what went on, except you laughed a lot. Los Angeles Times. A game cast delivers the barrage of banter with an arch coyness that suggests they think they're in some Generation X Neil Simon play. People. If fans of Mad About You and Seinfeld can handle the age difference, they should feel right at home with the six as they sit around riffing on life, love, relationships, jobs, and each other. The Baltimore Sun. A couple of reviews hated it. One character says he dreamed he had a telephone for a penis, and when it rang, it turned out to be his mother. And this is in the first 5 minutes. It's a ghastly creation. So bad. The stars include that cute Courtney Cox, formerly funny David Schwimmer, Lisa Kudrow, Matt LeBlanc, and Matthew Perry. They all look nice, and it's sad to see them degrading themselves. The Washington Post. Anemic and unworthy of its Thursday night time slot. Hartford Current. But then, Dick Rowe, an A&R man from Decca, in Turning Down the Beatles, told Brian Epstein in 1961 that guitar groups are on their way out. I wonder how those reviewers would feel now, having dissed arguably the most beloved show of all time. They really missed the boat on that one. Had they also hated Seinfeld, MASH, Cheers, St. Elsewhere? We were not on our way out. We were the very definition of prime time, when prime time still mattered. The gold rush of television. Even more important than the great reviews we dropped only about 20% of the audience for Mad About You, which was an incredibly strong performance for a new show. By episode 6, we were beating Mad About You, which meant we were a smash hit. Pretty soon, we hit the top 10, then the top 5, and we wouldn't leave the top 5 for a decade. This is unheard of, still. So here it was, fame, just as we'd predicted. Friends was huge, and I couldn't jeopardize that. I loved my co-actors. I loved the scripts. I loved everything about the show. But I was struggling with my addictions, which only added to my sense of shame. I had a secret, and no one could know. And even making the shows could be painful, as I admitted in the reunion in 2020. I felt like I was going to die if the live audience didn't laugh. And it's not healthy for sure. But I could sometimes say a line and they wouldn't laugh, and I would sweat and just like go into convulsions. If I didn't get the laugh I was supposed to get, I would freak out. I felt that every single night. This pressure left me in a bad place. And I also knew that of the 6 people making that show, only one of them was sick. The fame I'd yearned for had arrived, though. In London, it was as if we were the Beatles, with people outside our hotel room screaming, and the show ended up covering the globe. In late October 1995, between the airings of episodes 5 and 6 of season 2, I flew to New York to notch my first appearance on The Late Show, when going on Letterman was the pinnacle of pop culture fame. I was in a dark suit. At one point, Letterman would finger my lapel and describe it as late 60s British invasion kind of mod. Ladies and gentlemen, this man is on the number one show in America. Please welcome Matthew Perry. I sauntered out a star. I had made it. But I was so nervous I could barely stand, which was why I was quite happy to be sitting. I shook hands with Mr. Letterman and dove into my well-rehearsed routine. A long description of a typical Gilligan's Island episode. I somehow swung it so that I told the same story to Yasser Arafat, who was staying in my hotel. It was during the 50th anniversary of the UN, and everyone was in town. This was just the kind of bizarre, wordy story Letterman loved. The laughs landed. I even got Dave to crack up a few times. And my earth-shattering fear had been properly hidden. Everything was good. Everything was golden. I had just turned 25. I was in the biggest sitcom on the planet. I was in a hotel in New York, watching as world leaders were hustled into elevators by flanks of security, putting on a $1,000 suit ahead of joshing it up with Dave Letterman. This was fame. And just beyond the glare of the city, beyond the skyscrapers and the faint stars twinkling beyond the midtown skies, God looked down on me, just waiting it out. He's got all the time in the world. Fuck, he invented time. He wouldn't forget. Something was looming, and I had an idea what it was, but I did not know for sure. Something to do with drinking every night, but just how bad was it going to be? The juggernaut was just getting going, though. The show was a cultural touchstone. We were getting mobbed everywhere we went. David Schwimmer would later tell the story that he was accosted by a gaggle of young women on the street who physically pushed his girlfriend out of the way to get near him. By late 1995, right around the time of the Letterman appearance, I also had a new and very famous girlfriend of my own. But before we get there, I had some unfinished business with the other Chandler. I didn't hear from Craig Bierko for 2 years after I got Chandler. He had moved to New York and we'd lost touch. Best Friends, the show he chose over Friends Like Us, had gone nowhere. Later, Warren Littlefield, former network president of NBC, wrote in his memoir about Craig not choosing Friends. Thank God. There was something snidely whiplash about Craig Bierko. He seemed to have a lot of anger underneath. The attractive leading man who you love and can do comedy is very rare. He was working steadily. He'd eventually star in The Music Man on Broadway. The Long Kiss Goodnight with Gina Davis and Sam Jackson, among a lot of really awesome stuff. But the divergence of our fortune had left our friendship in flames. I missed him. He was still the quickest comedic mind I'd ever met, and I loved that, and much else, about him. I could no longer go to the Formosa to just hang out, either. I missed that life, too. I'd taken to drinking alone in my apartment because that was the safest. The illness was deepening, but I couldn't see it, not then. And if anyone saw how much I was drinking, they might be alarmed and ask me to stop. And stopping was, of course, impossible. One day, though, Craig Bierko called me out of the blue. He wanted to come by and see me. I was delighted, but apprehensive. You know that feeling when you end up dating someone your best friend had a crush on? It felt like that. I'd taken the role he could and should have taken. And everything had gone gold for me, then platinum, then some other rare metal as yet undiscovered. I had no idea how a meeting with my former friend would go. Marta Kaufman would later comment, "We saw a countless number of actors for Chandler, but things happened as they were supposed to happen." But I couldn't say anything like that to Craig, because the thing that was supposed to happen, the miracle, had happened to me, not to him. That had been his choice, not mine. When he got to my apartment, the tension was high. Craig spoke first. "I want you to know that I'm very sorry for not speaking to you for 2 years," he said. "I simply could not handle that you got rich and famous doing a role that I turned down. We were both good enough to get that role, and yeah, so I just couldn't handle it." I heard him out. There was a silence. The traffic on Sunset was backing up all the way to the Fred Segal on La Cienega. I decided I wouldn't mention Fred Segal. I hated what I was actually about to say, but I had to say it. I said, "You know what, Craig? It doesn't do what we all thought it would. It doesn't fix anything." What a sobering thought for a 26-year-old who had only ever wanted fame and had just realized that fame hadn't filled the holes at all. No, what had filled the holes was vodka. Craig stared at me. I don't think he believed me. I still don't think he believes me. I think you actually have to have all your dreams come true to realize they're the wrong dreams. Later, when I was promoting Studio 60 on the Sunset Strip, I told The Guardian I'd been on the least watched show in the history of television, Second Chance in 1987, and the most watched, Friends, and none of it really did what I thought it was going to do to my life. Given everything, there's no way I wouldn't change places with Craig and David Pressman and the guy in the gas station down the block. I'd change places with all of them in a minute and forever if only I could not be who I am, the way I am, bound on this wheel of fire. They don't have a brain that wants them dead. They sleep fine at night. I don't expect that would make them feel any better about the choices they made, the way their lives went. I would give it all up to not feel this way. I think about it all the time. It's no idle thought. It's a cold-hearted fact. The Faustian prayer I made was a stupid one. The prayer of a child. It was not based on anything real. But it became real. I have the money, the recognizability, and the near-death experiences to prove it. Interlude, Zoom. Finally, back in L.A. from Switzerland, it was COVID time. Everything, everywhere was shut down. We'd all closed ourselves up in little rooms terrified of death. My head was clearing up, though, and I was once again in a battle for sobriety. The pandemic was slightly easier for me to handle for two reasons. One, it was happening outside of my head. And two, it gave me a pretty damn good excuse for hiding out in my 10,400-square-foot apartment on the entire 40th floor of the Century Building in Century City. My ribs had started to feel a little bit better. At least, I was sobering up. That meant that I was slowly beginning to realize I was engaged, lived with a woman, and two dogs. Needless to say, I was not ready for any of this. You live with me? We live together? We have kids' names picked out? The whole nine yards. Hey, that's the name of a movie I made. You went down on one knee to propose, which really hurt your stomach, remember? I didn't remember. We broke up.